Good news, everyone. Women in STEM will be continuing into 2017. It may not be as regular as I'd hoped, but I'm really hoping to get at least up to episode 20 by the end of the year. Now, before we get into things, a couple of requests. Please leave a review on iTunes for this podcast. It helps let me know what you think, as well as helping to promote the show using the magical iTunes ranking thingy. Secondly, I've submitted this podcast to the new Castaway Awards, and it would be super awesome if you could go and give it a vote in the public voting category. I'll add the instructions in the description. So for our first episode of Women in STEM for 2017, I'd like to introduce Dr. Sally MacArthur. Dr. MacArthur is the director of the Swinburne Innovation Precinct, an initiative that aims to bring researchers, industry partners, mentors and others together to collaborate on developing new technologies and approaches. Always a bit of a science-minded person, Dr. MacArthur's career has taken her from Melbourne to Washington State and back again.
I always studied science at school. I went to a private school. It was very academic. It was academic and sport. That was what you were allowed to do pretty much. And, you know, I did all the maths and I did all the chemistries and physics. And I wasn't great at physics. I wasn't particularly brilliant at maths, but I was good at chemistry and I loved English. But I also had a passion for art and I did pottery.
Oh, very nice.
And so not super artistic, but really interested in it and interested in glazes. And how you form glazes. So I started looking at the chemistry of glazes, and that got me into thinking about what I might do next. And, of course, with that collection of subjects, everybody's just going, oh, you should do law.
No, you have to become a doctor. That's what you have to do.
Well, I was never going to have high enough marks. But my art teacher actually identified materials engineering for me. And suggested that I look at that because it was a combination of the things that I was actually interested in, and that it was sort of pottery engineering, I suppose.
Yeah.
But combination of subjects was sort of that. And the strengths that I had, I wouldn't ever recommend that you go to uni to do an engineering degree when your applied maths is not one of your stronger subjects, but that's okay. I think now it would be completely different because our maths expectations are so much different for university students.
Is that a good or a bad thing?
I think it's a great thing, actually. And I'm might be in a bit of a minority, but I think one of the reasons why we have so few women in a lot of STEM disciplines, of the STEM disciplines that have maths as a requirement, a lot of the girls have dropped out of early on. So if you raise the maths levels, we'll have fewer and fewer people. It's pointless complaining that nobody's taking the maths subjects at VCE when they're chasing after ATAR scores and things like that. And they don't want to do the subjects. But if you do them in an applied way once you get to uni and you can see where the context sits, I think we have to change the way we teach maths.
I was pointed at a paper today by a lady in the States who'd posited that science is inherently anti-feminist in the language that it uses.
I don't know about anti-feminist. I just think it is so dry so much of the time and often doesn't allow you in.
So it's sort of no passion.
No, well, yeah, there's passion, but it's passion in a way that it may not be actually massively gendered. It just doesn't let anybody in. It isn't contextualized. If you understand what the physical meaning is of something and where the maths then fits inside that, or the chemistry or the physics, suddenly this other world opens up. But when you're looking at it purely as here's some numbers or letters on a page, we're still letters on a page, and most of us really quite like algebra. You know, we can solve problems with it. You know, and actually somebody I was talking to last night said she had got really excited because she had to pull out her, she said, oh, she was thinking about a problem she had to solve and she said, oh, that's the X I have to solve it for. And then she was like, she was so excited that she'd actually used something.
I used high school maths for something.
But that's it. It's because we don't use it that way.
Mm.
And then we, you know, and I'm rubbish at stats. You can, and it's one of the most useful things you can be really good at. But
especially in science. I mean, it's sort of like makes up.
Well, I'm not a biological scientist. I'm an engineer. We don't mess with stats in engineering. We just add, we do a times three multiplier on it and say it's good.
Yeah.
It's a safety factor.
Every data point is a story in itself.
Oh, it's a snowflake and a baby to be, you know, gently warmed.
So how would you change it? Would you make it more story-based? Would you make maths or trying to teach science at high school more sort of this is a narrative rather than here's some facts on this paper?
I think you need to try it both ways. Mm. I think everybody gets at different times you need to get certain levels of information and everybody takes it in different ways and uses it in different ways. It's more a matter of finding the piece that helps you in. I'm not good at maths.
I'll put my hand up to not being good at maths.
Well, but that's sort of it's almost a cop-out along the way, though. Mm. So, I can't do any. It's not that we can't. It's just that we haven't had to.
Yep.
I think a lot of the time, I think if we had to nut it out, we're not silly. You know, we could work it out given help from somebody else to guide us through and show us. And the sort of stuff that you do around, I think, equations where you don't have to know any numbers. You can look at an equation and work out if something's going to get bigger, faster, or get really, really small, slowly. Just by looking, you don't have to put any numbers into the equation, but you can understand the relative impact.
The process of whether it's going to multiply or divide or...
Yeah, or if it's a logarithmic relationship and what that might mean. But sometimes it's, you know, for me, it's drawing a picture and saying, okay, well, that's what the graph looks like. So, oh, okay. And if I put those two pieces together, so it's maths, but not as we know it.
Jim.
and that's because it's in front of you and you can contextualize it. And it then suddenly you understand, oh, okay. Well, so me being able to break that equation back down into all its component parts. Work it back up suddenly becomes really useful because then I can work out what the kinetics of the on-off rate for that protein are. And
which,
that,
you know, I have to do all the time, really.
Don't you all. But they, I mean, it's the same as, I think it's an important skill to judge the stupidity of something you're being told.
Yes, thank you.
How's that?
So that comes down to critical thinking, though, as well, the ability to take the information in and process it in a way that you can come to a conclusion without having to rely on somebody else feeding it to you.
Yeah, or ask clever questions.
Yeah.
Ask the right questions. I would say that it's about asking the questions. You don't have to know all the answers, but you have to be able to. The critical thinking gives you the way of looking at the question and keeping on asking until the pieces drop together.
Or the right place to say, I don't know.
Oh, well, that's always. always time to say, I don't know.
All right. So you left high school, you got to university. What was the first, you got into materials engineering. How did that go?
I survived the first 2 years on the basis that I really wanted to hang out with the people I'd met.
So you fell in with a bad crowd.
I fell in with a fabulous crowd. People.
Oh, excellent.
University, I found my people. I found friends who I'm still friends with now, who, you know you really well and all those things. It's all those formative things that you do together.
Sometimes but, too well.
Oh, very formative. formative of brain connections.
Yeah.
In good and bad ways. But I, you know, I'd gone to university on... I mean, I pretty much got into Monash on an English grade and a pure maths grade
yep,
and a chemistry grade. And they don't really help you with the first year of engineering.
No, because
It's applied maths and physics.
Yeah.
And I'd done all the sub... I mean, and that's the thing. I had all the prerequisites. Mm. I wasn't lacking a prerequisite and I hadn't failed anything. It's just that, you know, there's lots of distraction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a short semester. It's all the stories that I have conversations with my students with now. It's like, do as I say, not as I did.
It's like being a parent, really.
Go to class.
But so this was also not a thing that had interested you before, wasn't it? This was having to do stuff that.
I come from a family of any scientists.
Yeah.
Parents are teachers,
mm-hmm.
And in English and primary school teachers. This is not something that I have any heritage to in my family at all.
Yeah.
And so, but it was sheer. Well, I wasn't failing. I was failing actually. I was failing subjects regularly, mm-hmm. but wasn't going to fail.
Yeah. There's so you were going to survive.
Yeah, I was going to survive, and by the end of second year. It was sort of I was getting the gist of it and how to do it and how to pass it. And there were more subjects that sort of made more sense to me. I hadn't finished maths yet. I was still doing that by fifth year because I only had to do materials engineering. You only had to do 2 years of maths,
mm-hmm.
which is still more than we probably do now. But I was still taking one of the second year maths subjects in my fifth year, which is a 4 year.
Perseverance.
Yeah, I always thought you had to be really thick to fail a subject twice, and then I hit a math subject.
Yeah, you're talking to a high school dropout, so that's okay.
Well, but the thing it did do was it meant I learnt that you could fail stuff,
mm-hmm.
and the world wouldn't end,
mm-hmm.
and you would just keep going. But it was important to keep going. That was actually the most important thing, I think, was to get through it. You'd committed to it. You'd started it. Weren't loving it, but there were bits of it that were a joy.
The Chumbawamba theory.
Pardon?
The Chumbawamba theory, I like to call it. You know, you get knocked down, you get back up again, and you have the whiskey drink.
Yeah. There was a bit of that.
Yeah.
But also I didn't fail a subject after second year.
Mm-hmm.
So, started getting better marks and did okay, not stellar. And I was surrounded by women who, very small cohort doing materials engineering. It's always a small cohort of 50% women, but when there's only eight of you, full stop.
So how many women actually, survived the whole course, the whole degree?
Well, when I graduated, there was a cohort of eight.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how many there would have been far more than that started. But the time you're all sort of spread out, though,
mm-hmm.
You're getting a bit patchy at that stage. You've got people doing double degrees with things and all sorts of other things.
So they sort of wandered off a bit.
Yeah, everybody wanders off in most degrees at some point.
Mm.
When there's a small cohort, it's much more noticeable. And I think that – because I seem to remember that we had a guy in our year who was – umpiring for the Australian Open.
Okay.
Yeah, and being taken to, I think he was umpiring at Wimbledon halfway through our final year. So he was making choices.
Which is going to be more successful, tennis umpiring or a science degree? I'm going to go with tennis umpiring.
No materials. And also, you've got to remember, this was the mid-1990s. There were no jobs.
Yeah.
Absolutely none. It was just dire.
Mm. Hence the tennis umpiring looked really good at that time.
It was probably a really good option. I must admit, I don't think I ever really looked for work at that point beyond getting the work experience I needed.
Mm.
Because by that point I'd realised I'd done one subject on biomaterials in my materials engineering degree and went, oh, this is really cool. It's got people.
And it's microbes.
Yeah, well, not just microbes. Actually, it was still hardcore materials engineering, but it was materials engineering that went into people's bodies.
Mm.
And it was trying to replicate the structures inside your body.
Cool.
So it was how metals could and couldn't replicate how bone worked and why they couldn't do what bone did and things like that.
Why their hip keeps falling out.
Yeah, exactly. And micro fretting and things like that, which in the context.
I have to ask, what is micro fretting? It sounds like a really small worry.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly where it comes from.
Okay.
It's a small rubbing. It's a small rub effect. So you get micro movement and then you get fret in the metal. So you're just taking
off
the fixes. Yeah, it's fretting.
Okay. I've learned
it's
something. Excellent.
Not do those hand actions.
This is an audio only podcast, so don't worry.
Very good thing. Yeah, and so you get movement inside a hip joint or something like that where the hip the bone around it loosens. Mm-hmm. So the implant is actually just got enough movement that it can move up and down or sideways and
start jarring and all
that.
Yeah,
you get fretting of the metal sometimes, but yeah.
All right. So you survived university, you got your degree, and you discovered biomaterials. You did your PhD in contact lenses.
I did a master's in between.
Okay. So what did you do for your master's?
A master's in biomedical engineering, because I went, oh, this biomaterials stuff is great. And I didn't have fantastic marks because, you know, I'd failed summer first and second year. And metallurgy possibly wasn't my best friend, which is funny coming to go where I went to later. Mm-hmm. I major metallurgy school. But I did a master's in biomedical engineering. I had I graduated with a 2B honours. So the lower second class honours, which you can't get into anything after that. And I didn't actually have any intention of studying any higher degree level. I was just interested in what biomedical engineering as a career looked like. And unfortunately, I didn't think it through probably enough. And it was an electrical engineering degree.
Okay.
It's based around instrumentation and imaging and ultrasound and all of those sorts of things. And I had no background. I'd done some. Mm-hmm. I was an engineer, but I'd done some. So I aced the biomaterials unit that was taught by people from CSIRO.
Mm-hmm.
St Monash and CSIRO Materials Division Biomaterials was just across the road.
Yep.
And in that class, one evening, it was all taught at night. And in that class, I can't remember whether Hans Grieser or Gordon Mays walked in to teach it and said, oh, and by the way, we've got a 6-month position for a technician. We're looking for somebody with a biomaterials background or who's interested. And I pretty much stared everybody else down, ooh, 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 ooh. Mr. Gardner. and I harassed them until they gave me the job. Yep. So I finished my master's at the same time as working for CSIRO as a technician in the labs. And that's where I started working on the contact lens projects.
So what was the contact lens project?
I did my PhD. I've got my PhD is officially it's from the School of Science and Technology at UNSW, but it was from the Department of Optometry.
Mm-hmm.
Because my supervisor at the university was in the School of Optometry.
So you had a bit of a serpentine journey going there.
Well, except for the fact that my PhD was actually based at CSIRO in the biomaterials group there, and it was always about materials and coatings, but it happened to be materials and coatings for contact lenses.
Okay.
And the project that we were on was sponsored by industry.
Mm.
It was part of a CRC. It was the CRC for eye research, and it was sponsored by CIBA Vision. And we were part of the project that CSIRO now holds out as the extended wear contact lens.
Mm-hmm.
They developed the new materials. I was part of the team that did some of the work in that. So that's what was happening. So all through my PhD, they were moving that product into production.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing a project that was peripheral but associated with it. So that was the best thing. It was, you were watching the commercialization of fundamental materials turned into product, and that was just amazing.
So that sort of introduced you to the commercialization side, the not just doing the academic exercises but turning it into a real product sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't think I knew it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that I was looking at that we were looking at commercial stuff, and I knew that what I was seeing was, how manufacturing could work, or what the thoughts you had to have in mind when you were thinking about manufacturing something and you were doing the basic research to underpin that.
Yep.
So I didn't know any different because I was sitting in CSIRO. So, there's not lots of...
How cool is that?
Yeah, it was. I've got to say, doing a PhD at CSIRO surrounded by senior scientists who are fabulous at what they do and are willing to collaborate with you, and if you get out of your cubby hole and actually build collaborations, it's the best, absolutely the best experience. And just the wealth of expertise, it was a really big shock to leave there, go to a university and start a postdoc and go, where are all these, what is all these students?
We have to deal with students.
There are students? Isn't, or am I seeing a scientist?
Isn't that like the professor's lament? There are students?
No, no.
No, no.
Precious and they're our lifeblood. The only thing that we can guarantee our salaries with.
All right, so you've gone from finishing your degree, finishing your PhD, you've gone into and from the CSIRO back into uni. Mm-hmm. So how was that transition?
Well, I moved to America, so that's
okay. So how was that transition?
Yeah, I moved to Seattle, which is even better. So at the start of the noughties as well. So Nirvana was over, Pearl Jam was over.
Just at the end of .com boom.
Yeah.
I'm
my timing.
Yeah.
Really good, yeah.
You weren't working for a startup, were you?
No.
Oh, good.
Startups came a bit later. Well, they were starting at that point in some areas, and there was a lot of bio.com, yeah, more sort of bio tech particularly. But yeah. You know, not biomaterials, med tech at that point so much. 2 years at the University of Washington, and it was strategic, I think, at the time. It was the only one I went for. There was no job per se. It was another one of those networks of my postdoc boss rang my boss in my PhD and said, who have you got graduating? Who's good? And I think between them, they decided when I'd start work.
Oh, so you're graduating. By the way, you're moving to the US for 2 years. Here you go.
Well, it wasn't quite that, but it was close. It was, Sully, you could go from Hawaii to Seattle, couldn't you, in May? And this was in February. I'm like, I haven't started writing my thesis. Oh, you'll get it done. I handed in on the Saturday and moved to America went to Hawaii for Biomaterials Congress and then moved to Seattle on the Monday.
So how did you actually, because as I said, I'm a high school dropout. I haven't actually done the uni thing. How did you defend your thesis if you were in the States?
You don't defend it with a heavily bound copy going all over the world to people in paper form.
And what, beating them over the head with it? Or?
Yeah, exactly. In Australia, most of the time your PhD thesis goes out. It's like it's reviewed like a paper.
Okay. A
huge, ginormous paper. And people get really excited, I think, when they're invited to, you know, review a PhD from Australia until you tell them, this doesn't mean you get a trip.
No, you just got to read the thing.
Yeah, increasingly people are talking about doing vivas for them, so having that oral examination.
Yeah.
And we do it. Technology is helping us do it.
Mm.
But I actually quite like the way we do it in as much as it's three different opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in my case, it was three different opinions. I think at my university now it's two with a third as a backup.
Mm-hmm.
One of those opinions must be an international, and all three of mine were international. And that process gave me connections all over the world because people had read my PhD.
Yep.
And one of the gentlemen who was my PhD examiner has gone on to become a very, very dear friend because he really liked my PhD.
It was a page turner. I couldn't put it down.
Very cool. What I wrote. So my thing was getting the comments back. Actually, I moved to America and they thought I'd already passed my PhD because when you don't finish in the States.
Until you've actually done. Yeah.
And you do this final examination, but it's all internal in the States. Well, at the universities I've been associated with. So it's all internal. So it's a presentation and you're done pretty much. Mm. Whereas, obviously, mine had gone out to review hadn't even left the building when I left the building. You know, it hadn't gone anywhere. I left before it did. So I got to America and they said, we need some evidence that you've passed your PhD. And I'm like, I haven't passed. It might have. I don't think it's even gone out to the examiners yet. And they're like, we can't appoint you.
until you got your PhD.
Yeah. And I think I burst into tears at that point.
Well, I can't, I'm pretty sure I would as well.
Standing there, no money. At that point, the Australian dollar was worth 55 US cents.
Yeah.
So any money I had was worthless.
Yeah. So you survived Washington.
No, Washington was fabulous. It amazing school. I gave my first presentation to the biomaterials. They had a biomaterials symposium every week. And I gave my first presentation at it 8 weeks in or something and realized that the audience consisted of about 60% of my reference list for my PhD. So I knew I was pretty much in the right place.
Yes, but you also knew that they knew their stuff.
Oh, good, yeah. But there's nothing like that fire.
Mm-hmm.
And generally a supportive fire as well.
Yep.
It wasn't a demolish people approach. It was well, that's very interesting. But I think if you look at this piece of work and this piece of work, you might have another way of interpreting your data.
Cool.
That's a great way of saying you've got it wrong.
Yeah, but there's constructive ways of doing that and there's destructive ways of doing that.
It's like, well, there's two examples you might want to have a look at and just compare and contrast.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, for having that patience.
So, okay, what are you doing now? What is your role now?
My role now is as the director of Swim and Innovation Precinct.
Mm-hmm.
That's 50% of my role, and I've had that role since the start of the year. And the other 50% is currently research. So I have a pile of research students. A pile. That's the collective noun for research students.
So we're going back to those stories about what people get up to in uni now?
Not quite. We run a program called the Bioreactor at Swinburne, which is a new PhD program that we developed called a PhD in Tech Innovation. And the Bioreactor is an ARC research centre in, training centre in biodevices, so it's for the medtech community, and we work with industry, but the 10 PhD students we have in that cohort are from lots of different disciplines, from across the whole university's range of disciplines. Most of them are from, I think all of them are pretty much from outside the university, but they started their projects by meeting with our 9 industry partners and identifying what their capabilities were.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went out to the end user community. They went to doctors, surgeons, mm-hmm. they went to hospitals, they went to nurses, they spoke to nurses, they spoke to family, they spoke to anybody who would stand still long enough and identified each student had to identify 100 needs.
Okay.
In the medtech that could be medtech needs.
So it wasn't just a sort of esoteric project pulled out of the sky or something. They had to go out and get, this is a practical requirement. We need to do this.
There's a challenge here. And then they refined those needs down into opportunities for research.
Mm-hmm.
And they then proceeded to define those according to pretty broad guidelines, which were, it has to be a big enough problem that you would address with a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
It had to match the industry and industry partners' specifications, needs, capabilities.
Yep.
It needed to align somewhat to skills that they either had or felt that they could develop.
Mm-hmm.
And then they proceeded to refine. So with 10 students, we had about 1,000 opportunities. They got refined down on needs. They got refined down to about 100 opportunities. And each student proceeded to then sort of pull together project outlines for 3 or 4 and pitch them.
Okay.
To industry partners.
So a bit of a Shark's Den sort of deal as well.
Yeah, a little bit of a, Dragon's Den.
Dragon's Den, Shark's Den, I don't know.
Shark Tank.
Shark Tank, Dragon. Den, Dragon Shark Tank Dens.
Schnark.
Schnark, yes. It's Sharknado.
That's probably what it felt like to
them. Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. For these cohort, they're a pretty special bunch in that they cope with uncertainty quite well, mm-hmm. which normally you come into your PhD, you know your topic, you crack on.
Yeah.
And these guys came in and learnt a lot. They attended a lot of workshops. They learned a lot about the field. They learnt about industry, the sector.
Yep.
And
yep.
So their approach has been very, very different. And it's huge fun. It's just – so basically they then pitch their projects, and in the processes of pitching their projects, iterated them with us as there were three of us who mentored a designer, me as a materials engineer, and my colleague Paul Stoddart as a physicist. And we mentored them through that process generally. And then they pitched with the industry, and that, and we iterated their projects to refine them down to one or two that they then did a final pitch for.
Yep.
And they then, during that process, of course, they're talking to lots of academics around campus who had skills in the areas that they'd identified they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And then they proposed and invited the academics to join their teams.
So this, it's basically not just PhD, it's network building, it's contact building within industry, it's learning how to talk to people, an immensely valuable skill.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I've got to remember that my head shaking doesn't translate audio.
And generally this whole project management thing, which is not something I take it is generally taught in science class or science degrees.
Well, in the end, they had to write a business case
for
their PhDs alongside a research plan and develop a budget.
Okay.
So it's a proper project. It's, you know, they own that project and they are running that project.
And something may come, I mean, they'll get a PhD out of it, but they'll also get an actual physical thing.
In some cases, it's thing-based. In other in other cases, it's concept prototype-based more than massive thing, or it's understanding how a process might be built.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be linking together existing technology in a new way. Some of them are building completely new tech. Others are bringing together and exploring really relatively fundamental principles, actually, that there's a fundamental question we needed to get answered to move forward. So, you know, some of it's about know-how, as much as, you know, developing the know-how and the knowledge of how to do something as well. So each industry partner has a different set of criteria of the types of things that they were interested in exploring or capacity to link with. And that's really interesting.
So thanks to Sally for the first episode of Women in STEM for 2017. Now, I am looking for more women to interview, so if you know anyone who you think would be a good fit for this podcast, please let me know. You can contact me via email at james@angrybeanie.com or Twitter, where I'm @PurserJ, that's PURSERJ, or @AB4Science. All right, until next time, thanks for listening.